Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and SDPB's Kara Hetland spoke with a local surgeon about treatments, prevention, as well as what's new in the field of breast cancer research. Dr. Tricia Merrigan is a breast surgeon with Avera Medical Group Comprehensive Breast Care in Sioux Falls. She's part of a team of physicians who treat women diagnosed with breast cancer.
We have, you know, obviously breast surgeons involved, medical oncologists, the radiation oncologists, the plastic surgeons, the radiologists, and we meet on a weekly basis. Every Wednesday morning, we present all of our new breast cancer cases. We look at that patient's mammograms. We look at their pathology, pictures of their cancer, and talk about aspects of their care. Is there additional imaging that we need to get because they have difficult mammograms, or we feel like we need to work up something else that we've noticed while looking at their images? We talk about, what therapies we feel like they may need. Should we do chemotherapy up front, or what we call neoadjuvant therapy, before they have surgery? Or should we operate first and then make those decisions? Do we think they're going to need radiation now or maybe later? And so we make those decisions as a team and make sure that we're not missing something.
So a woman has a lot of choices.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the concerns in South Dakota for me as a breast surgeon is that our mastectomy rate is one of the highest in the nation. And I think women need to understand that there are other options. Breast conservation is a safe option for early stage breast cancer, and that's stage 0, 1, or 2. There's no difference in overall survival between breast conservation and mastectomy. I think that's an important thing we just need to educate women and talk about, because there's this understanding that because I have a bigger surgery with a mastectomy that I'm going to do better overall, and that's not the case.
You can't get it back if you don't have them, right?
Well, there is a little bit increased risk of in-breast recurrence.
Right.
But if you take, you know, your run-of-the-mill early-stage breast cancer and you look at the numbers, you know, somewhere about a 6% in-breast recurrence versus a 3% with a mastectomy. So you really never get to zero because you can't theoretically remove every single breast cell. But those numbers are very low, and we know that patients with breast conservation do very well. And even the rates of second breast cancers are low. So somewhere between 0.25% to 0.5% per year, which most of the time that calculates to, you know, most women are a little bit older when they're diagnosed with breast cancer. Mid-50s is the most common age. I mean, about 2/3 are over 55.
Okay.
So if you say they live another, 30, 40 years, 0.5%, up to about 20%, where your lifetime risk initially was 12%. So, that fear of a second breast cancer is kind of something that's out there, but in all reality, isn't something they should really worry about. They're going to do well with breast conservation if that's, it's certainly a choice that they have.
Okay, so let's start and let's talk a little bit about the risk factors for breast cancer.
Okay. Well, the two main risk factors are just being female and growing older. Hmm. So those are two things that we can't really do much about. It is what it is. 2 out of 3 breast cancers diagnosed are in women 55 or older. But an important thing to remember is that 1 out of 6 are actually diagnosed in their 40s. So that kind of leads into the point of women should start getting mammograms at age 40, and it's yearly mammograms from then on as long as they're in good health. Another risk factor that's important is family history. Women with a mother or a sister or any first degree relative with breast cancer increases their risk about twofold. But the other point is that 85% of women diagnosed will not have a family history of breast cancer. So just because you don't have it in your family doesn't mean you're safe. So it's still important to get your mammograms and yearly breast exam by your provider. There are some reproductive factors such as what age you had children, onset of menses, when you go through menopause, those types of things. And those are small risks and small things you can do to kind of reduce your risk. But some of those aren't necessarily controllable either.
Why is it if you wait and have children in your first birth in your 30s or later?
Later. Some of that has to do with the hormone levels with a pregnancy a little bit later in life, and that increases your risk a little bit. Pregnancies before 30 are more protective, and that has to do with kind of the ovarian suppression that you get during pregnancy, and then also breastfeeding is protective. So I'm a big breastfeeding proponent. I think it's important. It reduces your risk of breast cancer. And so for every year that a patient breastfeeds, that actually can reduce their risk by a couple percent.
So breastfeed longer or have more children, which...
well, if you want to, yeah, have more children at an earlier age and breastfeed all of them for a long time. There you go.
There you go. who said there wasn't a cure, right? Sorry.
Well, yeah. So lifestyle factors also are important to talk about. We know that alcohol use is associated with increased risk of breast cancer. As little as 2 drinks a day can double your risk. So
really?
It's kind of a not a very well-known fact, but we know that that is pretty clearly associated with an increased risk. Smoking is a little bit controversial. Smoking, I could go on and on about the number of things that, you know, smoking is bad for. And so a little bit of it is just confounding factors with smoking and other things that go along with it. So it's hard to kind of separate out that one piece. But most of the stuff points to the fact that it is increased risk with breast cancer. Postmenopausal obesity is associated with increased risk, and that has to do with increased estrogen levels in a postmenopausal woman. The fat tissue that we have is actually fairly active, and it increases a woman's estrogen levels, and that increases their risk for breast cancer. And that kind of goes along with lack of exercise as well. Exercise, the more we look at the studies that look at exercise and prevention, the more we see that there is a significant risk reduction in women who exercise. It has to do with maintaining a healthy weight, but it also has to do with how the body deals with those estrogen levels. So in women who exercise anywhere between 3 hours to 7 hours a week, and that's just walking. It's not
right. That was my question. Define exercise.
Right. It's just walking an hour a day. So it's not the women who did the vigorous 10 hours a week had even more of a reduction, but just the walking an hour a day, 7 days a week, actually reduced their risk by about 14%.
Really?
So it's a significant reduction that you can get from exercise, and that's an important piece of prevention, as well as patients with breast cancer also do better if they exercise. So it's becoming more and more interesting to look at those types of studies.
Let's talk a little bit about genetic testing. Do you, if you know that you fall into genetic tests, that you have a risk, I mean,
sure,
that's on your plate, then can you reduce it by exercise and eating healthy and staying at a good weight and having lots of children and breastfeeding a long time?
So the families that we identify for genetic testing are families with multiple family members with breast and ovarian, or sometimes there are just families with several different types of cancers that we want to make sure we evaluate. And so all of those patients meet with our genetics counselor, get a family history, a very careful family history taken, and determine if there's any genetic testing that's needed. The most common genes that we're testing patients for are BRCA1 and 2. Those are the hereditary breast and ovarian cancer genes. That's associated with about a 60 to 80% lifetime risk of breast cancer and anywhere from a 20 to 40% lifetime risk of ovarian cancer. So in those instances where we have identified a patient with those genes, we definitely want to increase surveillance and talk about prophylactic surgery. So when I have women with those genes, I say, you know, at some point, you know, in your maybe mid-30s to 40s, think about doing a prophylactic mastectomy, you know, at least consider that option. Otherwise, we start MRIs at age 25 and then mammograms in their 30s, alternating with MRIs, and then we're following them closely with exams.
Because you can see better with an MRI than a mammogram?
Yes, we can. The majority of women, when they're young, have dense breast tissue. And so mammography is not very sensitive in a woman with very dense breast tissue. So MRI is a very specific and sensitive way to look at the breast tissue. So in individuals who truly have a genetic abnormality, there's some evidence that some of the things that they can do prevent it a little bit. They can even maybe take a pill for some chemo prevention, but in all honesty, they're at pretty significant risk. The ovarian piece is one of the ones that we talk about as well, because we have them see an OB-GYN and talk about prophylactic oophorectomy. That's, to me, almost more important if you carry a gene, because I can do MRIs and exams and I can find your breast cancer early if I'm looking for it. But all the screening that we do for ovarian cancer with ultrasound or blood tests is not very good. Mm-hmm. Even physical exams, it's just a difficult cancer to pick up early. Mm-hmm. And so to truly reduce their risk, they really should have their ovaries out when they're done childbearing. If you carry a BRCA gene.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you say, okay, I've had my...
Yeah, have your children. That's perfectly fine. And do those things. But when you're done childbearing, you really, with BRCA 1 and 2 mutations, you really want to get your ovaries removed to reduce your risk.
And what are the chances that there may be other genetic things that we don't yet know about?
Well, you have to, I mean, as a breast surgeon, we see these families who have multiple family members with breast cancer, and we've tested several of them, and they don't carry the BRCA1 and 2 mutations. So we know there are some other rare genes that we have found, and we have to assume that there are genetic abnormalities that we haven't found. We still test those families for the ones we know about, but then we have a collaborative research study where we ask those families to participate with blood draws, and then that blood is available for research to look for other genes. And hopefully we can find some of these other genes that can be affecting families and then test individuals for them. So all the time, you know, we're still constantly looking for other genetic abnormalities that we can identify. Absolutely.
And let's talk a little bit about some of the research and some of the studies that are happening here.
Sure.
Avera has a very high rate of participation.
We do. The national average of patients participating in a clinical trial is about 2-3%. Every patient who walks through the door at Avera is screened to see if they qualify to participate in a national clinical trial. And we have an average of 11% of patients participating in clinical trials. And that's an amazing thing to offer patients. Some of these studies are national studies, you know, that are happening at a lot of the big cancer institutes. And we're very lucky to have excellent people on our medical team and our research department who really have worked very hard to have our center be chosen to have some of these studies and to be able to offer them to patients.
And give me an example of what some of these studies are.
We have one of the most exciting ones we have going right now. It's called the Catherine trial. And to kind of explain it, there are certain markers that breast cancers can have. So we're learning more and more about the biology of breast cancer and learning that one patient's breast cancer is very different from another patient's because of the markers that they can have. There's three things we test breast cancers for: estrogen, progesterone, and this marker called HER2, which you can think of as an antenna on the breast cell. Certain breast cancers make about 1 to 2 million of these antennas versus a normal cell that would have about 10,000. And so those breast cancers are more aggressive because those proteins or those antennas, when they're activated, tell that cell to grow. Mm-hmm. So that's what we call HER2 positive breast cancer. And in situations with HER2 positive, we like to think about doing chemotherapy first, because we have directed chemotherapy for those patients. And then we get that patient's specific response to chemotherapy when we operate. Oftentimes we'll find a little bit of residual disease or no residual disease. So it's a good thing if when we operate, there's no cancer left. We know we still have to do the same surgery, but it's a good prognostic factor if we don't find anything. The Catherine trial is for HER2 positive patients who have had chemotherapy first. And then when we operate, if we find residual cancer, we know those patients are at a little bit higher risk because they still have some cancer left. So then the Catherine trial allows them to be randomized to continued Herceptin therapy, which is a directed chemotherapy for those HER2 positive cells, or to receive a new drug called T-DM1, which is a very exciting medication that you can think of it as like a Trojan horse for HER2-positive breast cancers. It has a very toxic chemotherapy bound to this receptor that when it joins the cell takes it in, and then the cell's enzymes open up the little packet that the chemotherapy is in, and then that chemotherapy kills that cell. So it's it has much lower side effects because it's so directed. And so that's in those patients who are a little bit higher risk because they had residual disease. That's a very exciting trial.
So then this drug could be available later on as the first one that comes with HER2?
If there's a benefit, yes. So
that's what you're testing now.
Yes. So what it's looking for is there a benefit? So the patient gets what they would typically get, the standard of care, versus maybe this new drug, which would potentially be better. And so we're looking at if that makes a difference then for those patients later who have residual disease, maybe they'll all get T-DM1 because those patients might do better. So that's what we're looking at.
And it's no longer the cookie cutter approach when you're diagnosed with breast cancer that well, we'll try this, and if this doesn't work, then we're going to try this. Now it is specific to the type of breast cancer that you have.
Correct.
And you mm-hmm. do better. You can be more successful.
Right. So overall, early stage breast cancer patients do very well. The therapies are determined by what type of markers your breast cancer has, you know, obviously the size, and if you have lymph node involvement. We're able to even convert some patients who would initially need a mastectomy to lumpectomy candidates with chemotherapy, doing that before surgery. Sometimes after surgery, if you have an estrogen-positive breast cancer, we actually test the genes of that breast cancer tumor itself to determine if that patient would benefit from chemotherapy. So that has really changed things as well, us understanding more of some tumors are more low-risk tumors, and the low-risk category of patients really don't benefit from chemotherapy because they have a low-risk chance that that tumor is going to show up down the road. So if you can change your percent by, if you change your risk by 2% with chemotherapy, there's really no benefit. But if you test the tumor and it comes back high risk, then you know this is clearly a patient who's going to benefit from chemotherapy and is going to do better because of that. So it's not the everyone over a 1 centimeter tumor gets chemotherapy anymore. It's very individualized. And that's the importance of having a comprehensive team and everyone involved in the treatment.
And so is the pendulum swinging from everybody just gets a mastectomy and let's just get rid of the problem to let's treat what's going on individually?
I think there is a trend. You know, we've seen since about the early 2000s, the mastectomy rate continues to go up. And we've really, in the breast world, tried to look at why that is. And that's nationally. We felt like some of it may have been due to just media exposure of some of the bilateral mastectomies and reconstruction and that type of thing. But I guess the take home is really to have patients understand that there is an option for breast conservation the majority of the time. And that's a safe option to talk about and to think about. We're trying to kind of bring the pendulum back more towards breast conservation. We have a lot of options for different techniques that we incorporate at the time of surgery to give that patient a little bit of a lift at the time of surgery, do some oncoplastic techniques where we try to make the breast look good after surgery. I mean, that's certainly the goal. We want to remove the tumor, make the breast look good, so the patient doesn't notice the area that they're missing. We kind of repair the tissue at the time of surgery. And then sometimes, obviously, if we lift one side, we'll lift the other so that they look the same. Insurance covers that. There's no reason to not do something to the other side to make the patient symmetric. Large-breasted women can have the option of a reduction at the time of their cancer surgery. There's just some things out there that are definite options for patients that I just think they just didn't know about. And so they're right. Important to talk about.
So it's important to ask.
Right, absolutely.
And to individualize your treatment.
Absolutely.